So both of you giving up your time this evening to speak with me. This is terrific.
No, thank you. We are certainly very excited about talking to you. Both of us have spent a long time researching mastery. Chris has talked about it a lot at conferences and written about it in his own book that he's released recently. And both of us worked for a private company who supplied professional learning. And that was when I contacted you. And that the whole premise of that company is sort of mastery learning. That company that's owned by Mark McCourt, who's written about mastery learning as well. So this was really a wonderful opportunity, and thanks very much for agreeing to do it.
Sure. Well, how can I help you?
So obviously I sent some questions, and I thought we could just kind of dance around these questions a little bit and just kind of take it from there. So the kind of first thing I just wanted to ask you was a little bit about your educational journey to this point, where you are now. To find out how you got to the point of really researching mastery learning, I suppose.
Okay. Well, I actually graduated from college with a degree in electrical engineering. But I discovered, sadly, that I'm not very good at that area, which was a terrible disappointment to my father, who was an engineer. And honestly, I was at a party one night talking to a friend who had been looking for a teaching job. And he told me about this private school that needed a middle grade mathematics teacher who would also do coaching. And I thought, well, that sounds sort of interesting. So I went and applied for the job, and they hired me. And I began teaching grades 7 and 8 without any background. Now, a contingency for my hiring was that I had to gain my certification. So I began then taking education classes and gained my certification. But after several years of being a middle grade teacher, I decided that I wanted to really go back to school to learn how to become a better teacher. And I began in studying in Boston. And then they recommended me to a program at the University of Chicago. And that is where I met Benjamin Bloom. He became my advisor. During my years of study there for my doctorate, was the chairman of my doctoral dissertation committee. And so that was how I became interested in the mastery learning, was through him. And then upon completing my degree, I worked with the Chicago schools implementing a variety of mastery learning programs in the public school system there. But the dilemma was that the school district would tell me we had to do certain things in a way, and then I'd share those with Benjamin Bloom, and he would say, oh, no, you have to do it in this way. And I was trying to serve two masters at the same time, and that got into some conflict from time to time. But it was great. And we just had, Bloom and I always had a sort of wonderful experience together. And then I actually put a book together of, when he passed away in 1999. And I was able to, through connections at the university, get a listing of all the doctoral students with whom he had worked during his time as a university professor. He actually began serving on doctoral committees there in 1948 and did so through 1991. Wow. I was one of his very last doctoral students. He chaired the doctoral committees of 66 students and served on the committees of 69 others. So with my connections at the university, I was able to get a list of all those people, and I wrote to them. And I said, if you have an interesting story, some experience you shared with them, I'd like you to send it to me. Well, it was amazing. I mean, within just days, I was getting notes and email messages from all around the world, and a real who's who of education. In fact, one day I was in my office at the university here. I'm going to eat from my home actually now, but, the telephone rang, and this really brusque voice said to me, Tom. I said, yes. He said, this is Torsten Hussein. Now, have you ever heard of Torsten Hussein? He's a very prominent educator, known mostly through Europe. But he said, I can't talk long. I'm here in Stockholm, and we're making decisions about the Nobels for next year. But I wanted to tell you, I got your note, and I'm going to send you some things. Now, this is a man who's deciding who's going to get the Nobel Peace Prizes. He's calling me on their break. And he sent me two different stories, but unfortunately they were both in Swedish and I had to have them translated. But it was wonderful putting all these together. And then I asked his wife, who was still living at the time, to write a foreword to the book. And she did wrote this beautiful story about what it was like for them as a young couple and how they met, sort of her background with him as he worked through these different aspects of his career. And we just called it Benjamin Boom Portraits of an Educator. It was just this collection of stories of all these people that had worked with him and what they had learned from him. And some of them are very touching and heartwarming, and others are just really funny.
Excellent. Because I'm going to ask you what Benjamin Bloom is your PhD advisor. So you kind of answered that. So I suppose the first question I really just for people that are going to watch this afterwards, because the people will get to see this recording. So what is mastery learning? Like, how could you sum up what mastery learning is?
Well, again, because of my background with Bloom, I always go back to his original writings on this. And it was actually his first writing about this was published in 1968. And at that time, there was a lot of work being done on trying to individualize instruction. Bloom was very much influenced by a former classmate of his at the university. Bloom had done his doctoral work also at the University of Chicago under the direction of Ralph Tyler. Tyler was sort of the father of evaluation. And one of his classmates at that time was another fellow by the name of John Carroll. And John Carroll graduated from the University of Chicago and then took a faculty position at Harvard University. And in 1963, John Carroll wrote this beautiful argument about how we interpret the idea of aptitude for learning. Carroll suggested that traditionally we have thought of aptitude as the level to which a person could learn a subject. And so if you had high aptitude in a subject, you'd be able to learn the most complex things with regard to the subject. And if you had low aptitude, you'd only be able to learn the more simple things in that subject. Well, what Carroll did is he looked at children when they were in elementary grades. And he said, if you look at children in like grade 3 and look at their reading level, some are reading advanced and they're up at the grade 4 and grade 5 levels, and others are behind, they're still at the first and second grade levels. But if you look at those same children when they reach grade 5, by grade 5, all have reached the grade 3 level. It took some 5 years to get there. So Carroll said, aptitude really is not a measure of how well you can learn. It's a measure of how long it takes you to learn to a particular level. To Carroll, aptitude was a measure of learning rate. And so instead of having good learners and poor learners in every subject, what we had were fast learners and slow learners. That it was very subject specific, that you could be a fast learner in math, but a slower learner in language arts. You could be a fast learner in science and slower in music or thing like that. But it was individual, but it was really learning rate. So it was from Carroll's idea of having fast and slow learners that we developed this whole idea in education to have individualized instructional programs that would allow students to go through a series of learning units at their own learning rate. And that tended to work out okay, except when you tried to adapt it to group-based instruction. Because in group-based instruction, what happened is that students, and especially young children, were not good managers of their own learning rate. And so those who learned fast tended to accelerate their pace, and those who learned slow tended to fall further and further behind. That you really needed some adult supervision to determine it. That it depended on a single learning sequence for everyone. And what we discovered since that is that not only do people learn in different ways, they learn things in different order. And so if you're struggling with unit 3, maybe you should go on to unit 4 and come back to unit 3 at a later time. And that wasn't possible in these sort of one direction individualized programs. It also did not fit well with curriculum demands of schools, where we only had children for so many hours at a different grade level. And so many grades, we didn't want children when they were 16 years old sitting in a grade 4 level class. It just wasn't going to be possible. So Bloom recognized all this. And what he did was to try to understand what we could do to adapt the best conditions of individualized instruction to a group-based learning situation. And so that's why he drew from two different sources of evidence. The first was he looked at a group of studies on tutoring, because he thought of all instructional conditions, that had to be the very best. That if you could provide for every student an excellent tutor who could work with them one-on-one the entire school day, what great progress you could make. But the second thing that he drew from were another group of studies that looked at the strategies of successful students when they are in group-based situations. So in a group-based class, what do successful students do that their less successful counterparts don't do? And from that, then he returned to the work of what takes place in the classroom. And he found that, organizing the learning into a sequence of units was a pretty good idea. He also felt that it was after the teacher would teach, to administer some sort of assessment was a good idea. You needed to find out if your initial instruction was effective or not. But right here is where he proposed a change. He suggested instead of that assessment marking the end of the learning unit, that we should use it as part of the instructional sequence and as primarily a feedback device. And it was Bloom who in 1968 borrowed a term that had been developed just a year earlier in 1967 by Michael Scriven. Michael Scriven was a sort of philosopher, but he was into evaluation. And Scriven in 1967 argued that the problem with most program evaluation is that we wait to the end to try to figure out what had happened. And Scriven suggested that we should be gathering information as the program is being implemented incrementally to find out how things are going and then provide feedback to the program developers. That way they could make changes as it was being implemented, and they would be likely to be more successful at the end. He called that interim evaluation formative and the evaluation at the end summative. Well, Bloom and Scriven were actually quite good friends. And the following year, Bloom suggested taking Scriven's word and adapting them to education, that we should give these regular checks on learning progress that Bloom called formative assessments, and to provide feedback to students about how well they've learned those expected learning goals, and also feedback to the teacher about how good their initial instruction was, for whom it was good. But then Bloom suggested that the assessments by themselves were not going to make a difference, that teachers had to do something with that evidence. And so he recommended pairing with his feedback what he called correctives, a new and different approach to teaching those same ideas. Bloom recognized that students do learn in different ways, and most teachers teach in a way that they learn best, not necessarily the way that some of their students learn best. So in these correctives, teachers had to present the material differently or engage students in learning differently than they did in the original instruction. And when Bloom was asked, well, what would be a good corrective? He said, well, that's impossible to say because we don't know what the initial instruction was. It just has to be different from the original instruction, a different presentation, different engagement. And following that, then Bloom suggested giving a second formative assessment. This second assessment was given for two reasons. The first was to determine how well the correctives had worked, if they had really helped students remedy any learning problems. And then the second was to give students a second chance at success. Hence, it became a very powerful motivation device. And Bloom's idea that if you followed that sequence, that you might be able to get 80 to 90% of the students really reaching a high level of learning that typically only about 20% of students do when more traditional instruction takes place. And that was then the premise of what he called, in 1968, he labeled it Learning for Mastery. And then 2 years later, he wrote another article where he changed the name, and in 1971, called it Mastery Learning. And that was how the ideas were initiated.
Yeah, it's I've tried to read around the history of it. It's fascinating when you go further back than that, and my previous employer and boss, Mark McCourt, obviously he knows the history really well as well. When we go back, way back, and talk about lots of different people who contributed to the ideas as well. But I find it absolutely fascinating how it just seems something that's so simple now when you think about it.
Yes.
But no one was really considering that, and it was just like this kind of factory of moving kids on, like that kind of conveyor belt idea, which is a shame. So I suppose I'll go for one more question, then I'll let Chris jump in. Obviously, mastery learning, like if you do a Google search on mastery learning, you'll turn up lots and lots of papers by yourself and Bloom and lots of other people as well. And it's been proven to work time and time again. And the paper that really sticks in my mind is the paper by Brian Whiting and others, where he has that really large and long study, and he kind of proves that it works. Obviously, the subject is not our subject, which is mathematics. What we don't find is we don't find that it's that widespread across the globe. It's certainly not widespread in the UK. There's people who have misinterpreted it, but it's definitely not widespread. But why do you think that might be?
Well, tell me more. I'm not sure I understand.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, like the mastery learning has been proven to work time and time again. From what I've read, we can see lots of different studies that have proven that it's successful, it will work. And obviously in your publication, Implementing Mastery Learning, you've given like a guide on how teachers and educators and administrators could tackle the problem of trying to implement it. Both Chris and I have had our own attempts at implementing for just a department of mathematics, and we've seen success with it. But we don't find that it's an idea that's that widespread across schools across the country and across the globe. I was just wondering what your take on that is, and if you think it is, or is there any reasons why you think it might not be?
Yeah, well, that's a really fascinating issue. And probably if we had the answer, we'd be all far smarter and richer than we are today. But no, it's that's such an important point. I mean, this has always proven to be effective. There's probably not another educational innovation, if we want to call it that, or strategy or technique that has been more thoroughly investigated and consistently found to be effective than Bloom's idea in mastery learning. I know that even for myself, I have found it frustrating because of there not being a grander acceptance of the ideas. But another frustrating part of it for me has been that people take aspects of this and they rename it and then claim it as their own.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have this sense in education as other fields do, that we have an established knowledge base and it's our responsibility to continue to build on that knowledge base. We go back to things over and over again. And just call them something else. I mean, when I say to people, for example, do you know who developed the term formative assessment? They will tell me things, well, it definitely came from Dylan Wilm, you know, or Black in 1989, or other people that have worked on it since. And I say, no, actually, the first book that was written of this was published in 1971. By Benjamin Bloom and colleagues, you know, Handbook on Formative and Summative Evaluation of Student Learning. I actually, in preparing for a presentation 2 years ago, I gathered all the books that I could find, published books, that had the word formative in the title. And I was able to gather all of those books. There were 34 of them. And I tried to see if they cited Benjamin Bloom. One would think that if you're writing a book on formative assessment, you probably would be talking about who developed the term. Do you know of those actually 37 books, only 4 cited Benjamin Bloom? Right? And you think, wow, what? Why not? I mean, here's the man who developed the ideas. We have this knowledge base and we need to build on this. And even the way he defined formatives has been changed and altered over the year. People have taken different perspectives on it. And I think it's hard for us to build on this knowledge base and really advance as a profession when we don't have that recognition. we don't go back and honor the wonderful contributions of these brilliant people that have come before us. I know some years ago, I proposed to present at the American Education Research Association meeting a symposium on evaluation. And I asked Ralph Tyler, who is Benjamin Bloom's mentor, if he would present. And he graciously accepted. And I can recall, he wrote a book in 1948 called Basic Principles of Curriculum Instruction. And in this book, Tyler develops this idea that before you can teach anyone anything, there are two fundamental decisions you have to make. You must decide what it is you want students to learn. And second, you must decide what evidence you would accept to verify they learned it. Well, that's pretty straightforward. And he made this clear. This was the sort of the premise of all of our outcome-based approaches and our standards-based approaches and goal-based education. So he made this presentation, and in the very front of the group, there was a young graduate student, a young fellow, who raised his hand, and he said to Tyler, he said, "Mr. Tyler, I'm very impressed by what you said today. It's I think it's all very clear, but to be honest with you, I don't see any difference between what you said today and what you described in 1949. And Tyler, without batting an eye, said, "Well, son, you have to understand, every 20 years, I become popular in education again." And it's that sense that we keep having to go back and rediscover these ideas. So it's odd that you should say that, because I'm working on a new edition for the Implementing Mastery Learning book, primarily because there's now a resurgence of interest in this. Some almost 20 years after the earlier version came out.
It's fascinating. There's obviously huge misinterpretations of it in this country. You know, you see the word mastery getting thrown around a lot. But like you just described there, no one ever references Benjamin Bloom when they talk about mastery. You'll see lots of different programs available called Mastery in Mathematics and stuff like this, and it's got nothing to do with the original idea of mastery learning. Chris, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, sure, fine. Actually, adding on to that, I recently purchased a book, and the book was about debates about the meaning of the word mastery and what mastery learning is about, as if it was a debate. And sure enough, that book barely mentioned Bloom at all. There was nothing about it or yourself. But in fact, to me, that your work and Benjamin Bloom's work is quintessentially what mastery learning is. So I found that quite amusing, but a deep shame as well. Can I ask a couple of technical questions? I suppose getting into the weeds a little bit. Right, so Gary and I are both heads of secondary school, high school mathematics departments. So when students get to us, they've already been in school for 7 years. So we're not starting at the beginning. And that gives a few issues. The first is that they all have different levels of knowledge and understanding of the curriculum. They're all at different points in the curriculum. Now, there's a big push in Scotland in particular, at times there's a pressure that we should be doing mixed attainment grouping. So we shouldn't be setting the pupils in any way, like the classes should be completely a mix of all sorts of prior attainment, basically. And what I want to know is, in our understanding, I'm sure Gary would be the same, in order to make mastery learning effective at the point where we're picking up the students, we need to have some form of homogenous grouping. We need to have the classes set in some way. What is your take on that?
Yeah. Well, again, that was one of the basic premises of Bloom's work in mastery learning, was exactly that issue, that he recognized that when we have students at the beginning of any instructional sequence, there is some diversity in the level of skill and talent and knowledge that they bring to that unit. And how do we plan effective instruction given that diversity from the beginning? Now, Bloom's idea was that you should always start at a level that would be attainable by all students, even if that meant dropping back a bit. But the idea was that you enter that first unit very quickly and get to the formative assessment so students can demonstrate their mastery. Now, this is another component that Bloom really stressed that a lot of people have missed. Bloom stressed that when you administer that first assessment, and some students will demonstrate they have really learned well. Either they knew it before you started, or the initial instruction was highly appropriate, so they have mastered, reached the level of mastery you chose. We don't want them just sitting around biding their time while everybody else catches up. For those students, Bloom stressed we have to provide an exciting and challenging learning opportunity that gives them a chance to extend their learning, what he called enrichment. Some people have called it, and actually in some of his writings referred to it as extension. And what Bloom described that as, he said, it does not have to be tied to the content of that unit. He felt that was far too restrictive, although it should be related to the subject area. So if I'm working in a mathematics class, my enrichment should be mathematics related, but it doesn't have to be tied to the content of the unit I'm currently teaching. It might extend students' thinking into aspects of calculus or topography or some other area, something that they might have keen interest in. Bloom said that instead, often in individualized programs, if you demonstrate mastery, the only option available to you is the next unit. And Bloom stressed that we have to provide students with opportunities for choice to see there are lots of avenues you can pursue in the subject area other than just the next unit. And it was that spectrum of things that he recommended we consider. He also stressed that one of the ways to make this easier for teachers is to consider materials and activities that are developed for gifted and talented. That more and more today, we find publishers turning their attention to materials for gifted and talented, and they are typically higher level skills. Oftentimes they are game-like, they can become very engaging with students, but they extend their learning into higher levels too. And Bloom suggested that's the direction that we should go. He felt that if you try to use the mastery learning without enrichment, that you'd be denying valuable learning opportunities for those very bright students that come in and start. Now, right from the beginning, Bloom also stressed that in any way we group students, there will always be some whose learning problems are so severe that we really need to provide special kinds of educational programs for them. He thought that would be maybe the bottom 5 to possibly 10%. He also recognized that there will always be some students who are so very bright and so very talented, they should have special programs designed for them too. He felt that might be the top 5 to 10%. Mastery learning was designed to address the learning needs of the 80 to 90% fall between those two extremes. So Bloom would still be a strong advocate of special education for those with severe learning problems or gifted education, those that are extremely talented. He said, we just can't address all those needs within a group-based environment. But for the 80 to 90% of students that fall between those extremes, that's what mastery learning was designed to give teachers a better way to address.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Thanks for that answer.
Let me add one thing. There's a doctoral student at Bloom's by the name of Leighton. It's Leyton. And Leighton investigated the notion of students entering a class not having the identified prerequisites to really start learning well. And in his study, he chose high school classes where those prerequisites would be easily identified. So, for example, he chose in mathematics, he chose Algebra 2, because to do well in Algebra 2, you must have a substantial understanding of Algebra 1. And he chose French 2, second year language classes, where those prerequisites were easy to identify. In Leighton's study, he asked teachers to identify those prerequisites and give a little quiz at the start of the school year on those prerequisites. And after they gave that quiz, they divided the class into two groups. For half of the classes, the teachers spent the first 2 weeks teaching students those prerequisites to a mastery level. And the other classes just began in the normal instructional sequence. Then within each of those two, he separated again. And those that were taught the prerequisites, he had some of them continue using mastery learning and some not. And those who were not included in the prerequisites, some using mastery learning and some not. So basically, Layton had four different groups in his study that he was able to attain through random assignments. So it was very rigorous in design. One group had no prerequisites, no mastery learning. Another group just had the prerequisites. A third group had not the prerequisites, but the mastery learning. And the third group had both. Well, I was actually asked to help Layton with his study when I was a graduate student there. And I was asked what I thought was going to happen. And I said, well, I think working on the prerequisites will help in those initial early units, but it's not going to have an enduring effect. Then after about 3 or 4 units, I would see the effects of that kind of diminishing. Well, it turned out I was wrong. It doesn't happen often, but in this case, it clearly did. And what Layton found is that if you looked at the students who did not have prerequisites and did not have mastery learning, the students who obtained a very high grade on the final examination for the course, a grade of A in this case, was only about 8%. If they had the instruction on the prerequisites, it was about 28%, about a quarter of the class. If they had the mastery learning, right, it was about mainly 60% of the students in class. But if they had the prerequisites and the mastery learning, it was up to almost 70%. So the effects were cumulative. In other words, you took that mastery learning and you added this prerequisite instruction to it, it enhanced its effects even more. So it was a way to really narrow that gap of students initially entering a class and really bringing them all together in terms of some basic prerequisites so they could start on a more level playing field to begin the class.
Yeah, that's fascinating hearing that. And in fact, it flows into the next point I'd like to ask you about, and that's about time. One of the tensions I've experienced with mastery learning is giving pupils enough time to achieve mastery, because I think back to John B. Carroll and his model, and time is being one of the key variables that we have control over, how much time we allow pupils for learning, of course. And in my previous job as a head of department, when I built a curriculum which was designed to be mastery, learning based, we slowed down, but we ended up slowing down too much because we've got terminal examinations. Yeah, and there's this tension between slowing down enough in order to get a high rate of success and not slowing down too much that you don't actually get through the content.
Right.
So what's your experience of that?
Yeah, that's such a critical issue. And again, it was something that that was addressed in some of the early studies of mastery learning, because when John Carroll came along and said that we don't have good and poor learners, we have fast and slow, Bloom's contention was we can make the slow faster. See, Carroll had seen learning rate as a fairly stable characteristic, and Bloom believed it was alterable. He wrote this beautiful paper on sort of alterable variables in education, and it defined that learning rate to be an alterable variable. But your experience is not uncommon. What we find, and I actually have very similar experience in my class, because I teach courses at the university in what we call quantitative inquiry, but it's basically statistics. And I have a certain amount of material that I need to cover by the semester. And we have a semester exam that's given to all students, and they have to be ready for that. So that means that I know that I have to cover this material within this limited time. When I first begin using the mastery learning, my early units, they take more time. And it's absolutely essential. especially for the corrective work. We find that the corrective work must be done initially in class under the teacher's direction. That just to assign it as a homework assignment or in some special study period doesn't work. We find the students who need it the most are the least likely to take part. That it needs to be teacher directed so that teachers can actually engage students in that corrective work. That's why when people ask me, what do I do if those students don't do the correctives? My response is, you are assuming I gave them a choice. They have no choice. It's done in class, under my direction. I am right with them because I want them to see that there's a payoff. I want them to see they get something out of it. Because when they see the benefits, then they are more likely to take it on their own. So all my units before were five-day units. It was 5-5 throughout. Now my first unit is 7 days. Because I have the first assessment, the formative, I have about a period for the feedback, correctives, enrichment, and then the second assessment. That means I'm behind, right? But what happens is, as I move along, I start reducing the class time I allocate to correctives. I start out with about a class period, but after the third or fourth unit, I drop it down to half a class period, and I do get to the point where most of it can be done out of class. I don't have to take class time for it. You can get there, you just can't start there. In addition, because I'm compelling my students to stay with me, I don't have to spend as much time reviewing as I did before. And so when we get to these advanced units, they're going more rapidly. And then finally, another aspect that I've changed that has allowed me to get through the material is the notion of review. Before, what I would always do, I would always have lesson, 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 review, assessment. Now I don't. Now I have lesson, 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 formative. I never review prior to the first formative. I take the time normally I would have used for review, I shift it over to the corrective time. I find I'm a lot more efficient in my review. I don't have to review everything because I have the results from the assessment. With those results, I can concentrate on only the things that are major problems for my students. Plus, I freed up the students that don't need the review. They're engaged in enrichment. I'm working with a smaller group. I'm a lot more efficient. Now, it is true, in that class, this is an 18-week class. When we reach the midterm, I am one full unit behind the other professors who teach the same class. At the final exam, I'm one unit ahead. I'm covering more material than they using this process, but it's because of flexibility in the pacing. More time in early units, but less time later on. And when I get to those later units, I find I can go through them more rapidly. So the key is don't lose sight of where you want to be at the end. Just see your pathway to the end a bit more flexibly when you get there. And so where my later units, I was using 5 days for before, now I'm only using 4 days. And so I was able to cover just as much material, but I had to see the pacing more flexibly.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I suppose that's the challenge for us, is to get our students to understand that and appreciate the value of doing the correctives in their own time. But if we start there, then yeah, you're right, it isn't going to work. We need to make sure we give them that space and that time in class to do that and then build on it totally. Gary, do you want to ask the next question?
Sure. Thanks, Chris. It's kind of follows on from that as well, because I'm just going to talk a bit about my experience of that, which is like Chris has had, that time is the issue. And when I was reading your book again, Implementing Master Learning, I was looking at the part where you can indicate about the 2 week period of time for kind of older students, so the students that we would typically teach. Mm-hmm. And then I was thinking about, well, it's really difficult to try and determine how much children can learn within a period of time. I don't think anyone has really pinned that down yet, have they, in terms of they've really figured out how long it takes to learn particular topics in mathematics. Mm-hmm. But I suppose, does it, especially in a subject like mathematics, does all of this really hinge upon your curriculum being really well sequenced in such that unit two, if you're doing teaching unit one, then all of the prerequisites for Unit 2 or most of the prerequisites for Unit 2 lie within Unit 1, as an example, if that makes sense, Tom.
No, that's a really good point, Gary. In fact, when Bloom first wrote about implementation, he wasn't really good at that. When people would ask him these very difficult questions, his response was always, you know, I'm a theorist. You need to talk to people that are using the ideas. But he eventually got around to talking about some of those. And I like to think that it came from our experiences working together in this area and him seeing some of the dilemmas that we were confronting. But we came to understand that his notion of 2 weeks was a general sort of description based on his notion of curriculum development. But in terms of implementation, it was necessary to make those early units a bit shorter, because you were teaching students not only content, you were teaching them a learning process. And because both of those things were combined, you had to get them to experience the process a bit sooner. So we reduced those early units to make them shorter, to cover fewer skills, and also allow us to get students to that mastery level so they experience success. Okay. We found that success was the primary motivation for students. I mean, I always use the example when people ask me about motivation, I say, well, the key to motivation is success. And it really comes down to, I think, what video games have shown us so well. You know, we have this idea that we have to make our lessons engaging to students. We have to make it relevant to their lives. But if you think about video games, they never cared about that. They never paid attention to that. Pac-Man is my classic example. In Pac-Man, you know, kids gobbled up dots. There's nothing intrinsically motivating about that. You know, there's nothing that's relevant to anybody's life. And it's not behavioral. People would say, well, it's because of the reward. What happened with the video game if you got all the dots? They gave you more dots. Yeah. You know, that's like saying to a kid, look, do these 10 problems right, and I will give you 10 more to do, right? It had nothing to do with the reward. It was that notion of success. But video games recognize the kids have to see success pretty early.
Yeah.
They're not going to keep playing the game unless they experience some degree of success. Now, the key, even to Pac-Man, was that you got to die 3 times before the game was over. And then you could start again. And so it was that multiple opportunities to succeed after you recognize the mistakes you made. And so learning from your mistakes, but being able to see that success pretty early. So I think in terms of implementation, to have it work well, you need to shorten those first units. Instead of having it be 2 weeks, maybe have it be 3 days or 4 days. Get students into that so they can experience that success. And so the process then is well learned, and then you can build more content following the same process for them.
Yeah, that makes complete sense. I was just going to kind of follow that with one of the most fascinating papers that I've read on mastery learning is Kathleen Fitzpatrick's paper, the group-based mastery learning, a Robin Hood approach to instruction. I found that really fascinating because it's solely based on mathematics teachers. So, and I just found that the whole description of the model and the training that was put in place and how much detail Kathleen Fitzpatrick goes into on things like off-task behavior, and very much like you're talking about, that the pupils, the students get used to the successful learning experience.
Yes.
Which is really highly attractable in terms of implementing in terms of your school. But what I was trying to figure out was from that and from everything else I've read is how much in terms of a teacher's instruction do they change when they implement a mastery learning model?
Mm-hmm. Well, Bloom suggested early on that you didn't have to change at all.
Yeah.
There was that, in fact, he claimed that mastery learning was instruction free, that there was nothing in mastery learning told any teacher how to teach. And Bloom, even in his earliest papers, believed that those decisions should be left to the teacher. The teacher understood the context well, understood the students well, and was the expert in the subject. Now, We did note, and several of our early studies on mastery learning showed, that when teachers began planning for the mastery learning, and particularly the idea of the alignment between their instruction and the assessments, that it did change their teaching. That we stressed within the mastery learning that there should not be anything on a formative assessment your students haven't seen. That if there's something on the formative assessment that surprises them, something went wrong in the teaching.
Yeah.
No student should be surprised by anything on a formative assessment. And what teachers discovered as they began working with the mastery learning is that they weren't very sophisticated in the way they were designing their assessments to make sure they really captured their learning goals. And that's why so much of Bloom's book on the handbook on formative and summative evaluation, published in 1971, was devoted to the development of formative assessments, because he felt you had to build that assessment literacy so teachers could make sure that there was alignment between what they set out to teach, their instructional activities, the evaluation process at the end, that those had to be aligned, they had to fit together. And if you did that, then students would be able to succeed.
I think that the way I've always tried to describe like mastery learning to teachers is that it's like a complete change of mindset towards your instruction, essentially, where you're holding yourself kind of highly accountable to what's going on in the classroom. So whatever your formative assessment might look like nowadays that tends to be sort of kind of short, sharp sort of quizzes, maybe covering a few different topics. But it's about interrogating that data and deciding for yourself, right, clearly that particular topic I can see standing out. My teaching obviously wasn't impactful. I need to do something about it. It's nice to hear that. Chris, do you want to jump in with any others?
Well, let me add one thing too. The feedback that we talk about within mastery learning is not only for the students, but also for the teachers. So we always recommend that the teachers analyze results from the formative assessments by making just little tallies of how many students missed each question. So if I give a formative assessment and there's a question on there that half of my students missed, that's not a student learning problem. That's a teacher problem. And what that says to me is no matter how I taught it, it just didn't come across. So I will change my teaching based on the results of the formative. It's my feedback too. And so it lets me understand better what I did well and what I need to change. I used to think I was good at predicting that, but results have shown that I'm not. You know, there are times I teach lessons and I think they're magnificent. You know, I think, wow, I was on today. You know, we should have video cameras recording this. This was really good. And yeah. I asked my students and they didn't get it. And what this does is gives us that kind of verifiable evidence that we can really use to become better teachers.
Yeah, thanks for that.
One of the criticisms I've heard of mastery learning is that in the mathematics context, that it causes a focus on procedures and facts and definitions, a very kind of low-level skill, as opposed to higher order thinking, such as problem solving. Mm-hmm. I heard someone talk at a conference about this a couple of years ago. It wasn't a mastery talk, but she took the opportunity to have a go, to make some kind of negative comments about mastery learning, saying that it was a very kind of direct instruction type approach, almost Engelmann's type of work, where flair, problem solving, rich mathematical thinking didn't really have a place. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily agree with that, but I don't know if that's an argument that you've heard often before.
That's absolutely wrong. I mean, and because not only is mastery learning neutral with regard to how teachers teach, it's also neutral with regard to what. You know, there's nothing in mastery learning that tells teachers what their learning goals should be or what they aspire to have their students learn. Those are decisions that are made by the teacher. Now, it is true that those lower level skills are easier to assess and probably easier to teach. But Bloom, in his earliest writing, because of his work in the taxonomy, see, the Bloom's taxonomy was first, they started working on that in 1949. It wasn't, they had a publishable version of it in 1954, but it didn't get published first until 1956. But Bloom always had stressed that we really need to be focused on those higher level skills. But he recognized that mastery learning was going to help you no matter what level of skill you chose for your students. So, for example, in my classes, I make this announcement to my students. I say, look, I will never ask you a question on a formative assessment that you can look up on your phone. I'm just not going to do it. Because if you can look it up on your phone, it's not that valuable to me. I want you to do the kind of problem solving you're talking about, to be able to reason about these issues. And even in basic statistical concepts, here's an example. We teach measures of central tendency, and I want them to understand about average. But I don't ask them, give them numbers and ask them to calculate an average. What I say is this. I say, look, you are in charge of a school, and your job is to raise the average score students are attaining on a standardized test. Now, you cannot improve the teaching. How will you do it? Now, they can't look up that on their phone, but I get wonderful answers from students. You know, like one student put on this, she said, let's do this. Let's take all the at-risk children on a field trip the day we give the test. That would work, right? Knock out of those low scores, average goes way up. See, that's what I want my students to understand. Because otherwise people will play these games with them doing averages and they won't understand how those things came about. Or on my second assessment, I'll say, you want to sabotage the results. You want to lower the average score, but you can't make teaching any worse. How would you do that? Well, now we'd want to take all those gifted kids on the field trip. You know, we want to invite more low achieving kids into the school. And so I want them to understand the concept of averaging, but in a problem solving way with it. And so that's not the, I use mastery learning to help me accomplish that. So it's neutral with regard to how you teach. It's also neutral with regard to what. And if I, as a teacher, decide that my focus is on problem solving, higher level skills, application of new learning, transfer into new and different contexts, I can do that, and I can use mastery learning to help me do it even better.
That's fantastic. Really enjoyed hearing that. That's a great response.
Yeah.
And it does tie with our own experience to an extent, I think. I'll ask one more question. Conscious of your time. So you mentioned you're working on a new edition of your book on implementing mastery learning. I was wondering if you are still involved in academic research into mastery learning, or if you know of other contemporary research which is still going on it, or is it just so well established now that we don't need to investigate it anymore?
Yeah. Well, it's ironic you should ask that, because in preparing this new version of implementing mastery learning, I've spent quite a bit of time going back and looking at the research in modern studies. And what I'm finding is exactly what you suggested, that at the elementary and even the secondary level, there's this idea that that's all sort of old stuff. We've established that. We don't have to test that again. Most of the modern studies that I find taking place on mastery learning are occurring in professional schools. So you have a lot of studies now, new studies coming out of mastery learning that are conducted in medical schools for training physicians and training nurses and emergency technical people. You have a lot that are being done in schools of dentistry where they're using the mastery learning techniques. The other area is in military training. They've really taken on the techniques of mastery because, I mean, if what the military does, it takes these young men and women who are basically high school graduates at best, and they train them to operate some of the most technologically sophisticated equipment in the world. But What happens is that generals and admirals and commanders recognize that if this young person doesn't do their job, I die. The stakes are very high in this. And so they are really interested in instructional effectiveness. So you see a lot of mastery learning being incorporated in military training charter programs, and a lot of the studies coming out from that. And in we see studies in law as a professional school taking it on more, which it just fascinates me, because you would think all of our evidence from the early studies indicated that mastery learning was perhaps most effective in classes in the humanities. It really seemed to be something that we could do in the humanities, where a lot of the assessments required more writing. But you see these other applications of it going into these other areas and being very, very successful through there. Another area where many mastery learning studies have been conducted is now in third world nations, where they are just developing their education systems, and they need to make sure that they're highly effective. They don't have a lot of resources. They need to concentrate on things that will give them a lot of a payoff for their investment. And so in African nations and in particular, you see a lot of mastery learning going on in their teacher education programs. I was just contacted a couple weeks ago from the University of Tanzania, where their major teacher education program is focusing on the aspects of mastery learning.
Excellent. Thanks for that. That was really good. I've just got one kind of last question to finish off, Tom. And again, thanks very much for your time. And my question, I suppose, is that this is, Chris and I are in a very similar position. This is now our second time around in different schools trying to implement a mastery learning model. We never, ever, I suppose, finished it, so to speak, in our previous positions. We obviously have a much, much clearer picture now of what it means and what kind of needs to be done. What advice would you give a teacher who's never heard of mastery learning, and you're explaining it for the first time what it is? What advice would you give a teacher who would maybe be a bit scared of it, a bit wary of it? Any advice that would be interesting to hear?
Yeah. Well, I think that, just as with students, success is such a powerful motivation device. I tried to build that in with young teachers too. And I find that one of the struggles that young teachers have is they come out of their teacher preparation program convinced they are going to change the world. And yeah, within a very short time, they discover how hard it is and all these challenges that they face. And it leads to this terrible frustration. You know, they are so committed, but they lack tools and strategies to have the impact they really want. And I present mastery learning to them as that. It's a tool that you can use to accomplish what you really want to do, and that is to help more of your kids learn better. And to be able to take them through a short unit, take them through the mastery learning process, and just let them see the difference between a formative A and a formative B within that unit, how kids do better, how maybe students were failing before, they may not be getting the top grade, but they're passing. And just to see that amount of improvement, because the most fundamental thing for a teacher is to have impact on your students. And to be able to make sure that impact is positive is very powerful. So I tried to build in that mechanism of showing them that this can make a difference. It relates to, you know, the evaluation model that I developed for professional learning was based on the change premise that a lot of people, found very striking, but that traditionally in professional learning, we've had this idea that you first change people's attitudes and beliefs, that leads to some change in their practice, and then that leads to some changes in the student learning. I found there was a long history of our orientation toward this, dating back to the 1930s and 1940s. Kurt Lewin, a prominent change theorist, wrote a lot about that. He based many of his ideas on psychotherapeutic models. The problem is, all of our modern research on teacher change shows that's not the way it happens. The way it happens with teachers is changes in practice first, student learning second, attitudes and beliefs last. You see, it is experience that shapes the attitudes and beliefs. It's not the other way around.
Yeah.
And so I don't try to convince people up front that mastery learning will work for them. All I hope is that I can change them from being cynical to skeptical. If I can just get them to skeptical. Skeptical enough to say, I'm not so sure, but I'll give it a try.
Yeah.
And if I can get to that, if by giving it a try, they see it works, then the attitudes and beliefs will follow. But you've got to get them to that point. Get them just to give it a try and be able to show them that it makes a difference for them in their classrooms with their students. Then the hard work is done. They'll be on your side.